Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Joshua chapter 7. I'm going to cover verses 1 through 26, the entire chapter. We will see Israel suffer its first defeat at Ai. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 6, the Israelites whopped up on the city of Jericho and conquered it. So we start now in Jeremiah 7, verse 1. But the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. Therefore the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. So Joshua 7, verse 1 says the sons of Israel acted unfaithfully. Actually, it was only one of the Israelites that acted unfaithfully. It was Achan that acted unfaithfully. But all the sons of Israel get the blame. Achan's sin, apparently, was imputed to the rest of them. All the Israelites were liable until they found and punished the guilty party. This forced the Israelites, of course, to be very watchful of each other so that no sin would be tolerated. It was one for all and all for one in the people of Israel. Now, this Achan, who sinned, we'll see what he did in a minute. This Achan has a little genealogy given here. The son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah from the tribe of Judah. Now, it doesn't go any further than Zerah, but Zerah is the son of Judah and Tamar. Now, Judah, of course, is one of the 12 patriarchs, and his daughter-in-law Tamar dressed up like a prostitute by the side of the road and tricked Judah. Judah decides he wants to release some of his excess sexual energy and hires Tamar as a prostitute. His own daughter-in-law. He, of course, didn't know who she was because she was disguised. Tamar was trying to get pregnant because Judah had deprived her of her legitimate husbands. We'll get into that story when we get later on into the Old Testament. Now, why is this genealogy given here in verse 1? This is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown have to say on the subject. Quote, his genealogy is given probably to show that from a parentage so infamous, the descendants would not be carefully trained in the fear of God. Well, you can't go completely by genealogies. After all, Jesus had Rahab in his genealogy, and she was a prostitute. But that's probably why Joshua put it in there. The idea, bad ancestors, bad descendants. Maybe this is speculation. The anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. We'll see later why. As Adam Clark said, the Israelites' armies were defeated, 36 persons were killed, and general terror spread through the whole camp. We go now to Joshua 7, verse 2. Now Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth-Aven, east of Bethel, and said to them, go up and spy out the land. So the men went up and spied out Ai. Now I hope I'm pronouncing that right. In Chinese, that's the English romanization of several Chinese characters pronounced in four different ways. I, and I. The I pronunciation stands for love. So whenever I see that, it reminds me of love. But unfortunately, it had worse associations for the Israelites because this is the scene of their first defeat. Now let's see what Easton says about Ai. It means ruins. I think that's what Easton's means. It just says, he says ruins. I think that's what it means. One of the royal cities of the Canaanites. It was the scene of Joshua's defeat and afterwards of his victory. His victory will be in chapter 8, the next chapter. It was the second Canaanite city taken by Israel. Of course, the first was Jericho. It lay rebuilt and inhabited by the Benjamites. It lay to the east of Bethel, beside Beth-Aven. I'm going to show you on a map in a minute here where Ai, Bethel, and Beth-Aven are. Very close to the spot where they crossed the Jordan River. The spot is most probably the site of this ancient city as Haiyan. Again, that also sounds like Chinese. Hai is sea and Yan is I. 2 miles east from Bethel. Of course, that has nothing to do with it. So Ai is 2 miles east from Bethel, probably the site of another city called Haiyan. It lay up the Wadi Suwainit, a steep, rugged valley extending from the Jordan Valley to Bethel. John Gill says this is 3 or 4 miles from Jericho. Clark says it's about 10 or 12 miles from Jericho. Looking at the map, I think Clark is closer to the truth here. Looks like it's about 10 or 12 miles from Jericho, maybe even a little bit longer. And of course, the map from BibleAtlas.org has a question mark by it, so they're not exactly sure where it was, but it's not too far away. So let's look at the map here while I'm here. The Israelites crossed at Gilgal. If you look at Jerusalem, 20 miles to the northeast of Jerusalem is where Gilgal is. Then you go from Gilgal a little bit north and maybe a little bit further back east. But let's just say a little bit north. You're looking at about 6 or 7 miles according to this map. Then once you're at Jericho, where the Israelites were in the last chapter, and if you go basically west, maybe a little bit northwest, about 12, 13, 14 miles, you get to Ai. Now, once you're at Ai, you go another couple miles to the northwest, you get to Bethel. Now, Beth Avon is somewhere a little bit to the east of Bethel, but nobody knows where it is. It has a question mark. So we're still in a relatively constrained area of Jerusalem as the Israelites have crossed. Now, this city, Ai, was built upon a hill. John Gill says it was about a mile from Bethel, maybe a mile or two. We don't know exactly. It was apparently a strong place because Ai chose to risk a siege. And if it would have to be a relatively strong place to risk that, because after all, the Israelites had just wiped out Jericho with its walls. And so Ai says, well, Jericho went down, but they're not going to do that to us. So they stood and fought. Now, this Beth Avon, which is east of Bethel, I guess let's do Bethel first, because that's the most well-known place. That's, as I said, a couple more miles northwest of Ai. Bethel means house of God, and I'm reading from Easton's dictionary here. Now, Bethel is interesting because there's so much Old Testament history that happened there. It's worth going through this. It's a place in central Palestine about 10 miles north of Jerusalem at the head of the pass of Michmash and Ai. It was originally the royal Canaanite city of Luz. The name Bethel was at first apparently given to the sanctuary in the neighborhood of Luz and was not given to the city itself until after its conquest by the tribe of Ephraim, which we haven't gotten to yet. When Abram entered Canaan, he formed his second engagement between Bethel and Ai, and on his return from Egypt, he came back to it and again called upon the name of the Lord. So Bethel has got some connection with the ancient patriarch Abraham. Here at Bethel, Jacob, on his way from Beersheba to Haran, looking for his wife, had a vision of the angels of God descending and ascending on the ladder whose top reached into heaven. Of course, that's Jacob's famous ladder. And on his return, he again visited this place where God talked with him, and there he built an altar and called the place El Bethel, God, the house of God. To this second occasion of God speaking with Jacob at Bethel, Hosea makes reference. In troublous times, the people went to Bethel to ask counsel of God. This is in the book of Judges. Here, the Ark of the Covenant was kept for a long time under the care of Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron. Here also, Samuel held in rotation his court of justice. It was included in Israel after the kingdom was divided, and it became one of the seats of the worship of the golden calf. So now we're going from good to bad. Hence, the prophet Hosea calls it in contempt Beth Avon, which means house of nothingness or house of idols, because idols are nothing. Bethel remained an abode of priests even after the kingdom of Israel was desolated by the king of Assyria. At length, all traces of the idolatries were extirpated by Josiah, king of Judah, and the place was still in existence after the captivity. Captivity, of course, being 586 B.C. from Babylon. It has been identified with the ruins of Beitin, a small village amid extensive ruins some 9 miles south of Shiloh. So, it's ruins now, but it was a big, not big, but it was famously a city of great import in the history of Israel. Now, Beth Avon, according to Easton's dictionary, means house of nothingness, of idols. It's a place in the mountains of Benjamin, east of Bethel, and sometimes it's used as a metaphor. For example, the real city of Bethel is called Beth Avon, although Beth Avon was a real place. Bethel is sometimes metaphorically called Bethel because it became a house of nothing, a house of idols when the golden calves were put there. It was no longer the house of God, Bethel, but it became the house of idols, Beth Avon. All right, so much for our geography lesson. We go now to verses 3 through 5 of Joshua 7. These are the spies, or the scouts, they returned to Joshua and said to him, "Do not let all the people go up. Only about 2,000 or 3,000 men need to go up to Ai. Do not make all the people toil up there, for they are few." So about 3,000 men from the people went up to Ai, but they fled from the men of Ai. The men of Ai struck down about 36 of their men and pursued them from the gate as far as Shibarim and struck them down on the descent, so the hearts of the people melted and became as water. Now, 3,000 men went up to Ai. How many people were in Ai? The few that the scouts talked about, 12,000, because it says in Joshua 8:25, all who fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000. This is when the Israelites finally did defeat them in the next chapter. There were 12,000. Well, these 12,000 ran the 3,000 Israelites, and I don't know why the scouts said the Israelites, the Ai inhabitants are few, since they had 12,000 people, and the Israelites only sent 3,000 men, but that's what they did. They fled from the gate. The people of Ai in verse 5 pursued the Israelites from the gate. So apparently the forces of Ai came out of the gate and charged Israel. The Israelites probably marched up to the gate and expected Ai to surrender in fear. I mean, after all, we just won Jericho, right? Little object lesson here. Just because you have one spiritual victory doesn't mean the next one's coming. Just because you were holy and righteous and victorious in one battle doesn't mean that you don't have sin dragging you down to defeat in the next. So that's what happened. Now they were chased from the gate to a place called Shebarim. The NIV translates that as stone quarries, because that's what Shebarim means. It either had a name, Shebarim, or it was a not proper name. It just means they were chased as far as stone quarries, and there was no proper name given to it. It doesn't matter. Nobody knows anything about this place. And the Israelites were struck down on the descent. So Ai was on a hill. They went down. Ooh, that's bad. You're running downhill. There was no ordered retreat. It seems to be a panicked rout after the lines of the Israelites broke. And as a result of that, the hearts of the Israelites melted. Verse 5. Now you might ask, why were the Israelites so afraid? Since it was a small loss, 36 men out of 3,000 is not too bad. Well, it wasn't the casualty list that bothered them. It was the fact that they saw that God had forsaken them. God did not win that battle for them. And then they might have been thinking, Yahweh has abandoned us. Could be because Yahweh doesn't care about him anymore. I don't know what their hearts were thinking. I wonder if they thought it's because we have sin in the camp. Probably not. They probably thought that God had just abandoned them because they were a bunch of sorry losers. I don't know why, what they thought, but their hearts melted. We go now to Joshua 7, verses 6 through 9. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until the evening, both he and the elders of Israel. And they put dust on their heads. Joshua said, Alas, O Lord God, why did you ever bring this people over the Jordan, only to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us? If only we had been willing to dwell beyond the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say, since Israel has turned their back before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it, and they will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name? Now Joshua tearing his clothes with the elders there and putting dust on their heads. There was probably a solemn fast that was held at the same time, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculate, because that's generally what happened when you had a mourning fast, when you had a mourning ritual of tearing the garments, you usually accompanied that with a fast. Now, who are these elders that are putting dust on their heads and tearing their clothes along with Joshua? It's probably the 70 elders who were in charge of the whole Israel and the whole Hebrew nation, the whole Israelite nation. One of my commentators says, quote, these were either the elders of the people in the several tribes, or rather the 70 elders, which were the Sanhedrin or council in which attended Joshua and assisted him as such. In other words, each tribe had elders, but then there were 70 special elders out of the tribal elders who ruled the whole nation, not just one tribe, but the whole nation. Now, these people showed up at first in Exodus 24:1. This is out at Mount Sinai. Then he, God, Yahweh, said to Moses, Go up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of Israel's elders, and bow and worship at a distance. So there we have first mention of the 70 of Israel's elders, and apparently that passed all the way down to the New Testament times became to be called the Sanhedrin. Now, gotquestions.org says about this, quote, the 70 elders are mentioned as a unit and were most likely a distinct group selected from among the many other elders in Israel. Although we don't know for certain, these 70 were probably some of the men Moses chose after taking the advice from his father-in-law, Jethro. Remember, Jethro said, Moses, there are too many of them. You're going to get tired judging them. You need to get some other elders. And so it doesn't say 70 elders, but Exodus 18 says elders were chosen. And Exodus 24 says 70 of Israel's elders. So you can assume that there's probably 70 elders that were in charge of Israel. And now they're all moaning and groaning and weeping and crying and fasting and putting dust on their heads. which was a typical sign of mourning, by the way, in various ancient nations besides Israel. Now, Joshua in verse 7 says, God, why did you deliver us into the hand of the Amorites? Now, Amorites is a term like Canaanites. You can either use the term in a narrow sense or in a broad sense. If it's a narrow sense, that just represents a particular land, a particular tribe in the land of Canaan, and that would be some Amorites of that tribe who were around Jericho and Ai, or it could represent all of the tribes in Canaan, and sometimes the word is used that way. It doesn't really matter here either way, whether it's the Amorites and the Aiites representing all the other ites in Canaan, wiping out Joshua and the Israelites, or if it's just the particular tribe, doesn't matter. Point is, Joshua's worried about it. And then he makes a prayer, which is somewhat controversial. He sounds like he's complaining to God. He said, if only we had been willing to dwell beyond the Jordan, if we'd have just stayed on the east side and not gotten ourselves into this battle over here in the west, we would have been happy over there in the great pasture lands of Bashan. Of course, what Joshua doesn't say is there wasn't enough land over there for all 12 tribes, or just for 2.5 tribes. Now, when something goes wrong, it is really very easy to second guess the decision that got one there. Joshua was probably thinking the Israelites had gotten greedy, so he's second guessing the choice to go over the Jordan River. He's probably thinking the Israelites wanted a land even better than what was on the east of the Jordan, but he must have forgotten in his despair that the land on the west side was promised to him by God. John Gill says, quote, that Joshua, quote, speaks as a man confounded and at the utmost loss how to account for the power, the providence, and promises of God. Power, providence, and promises. That's a good alliteration. Now, as I said, many people say that Joshua was not being a good boy when he said, oh, Lord, it sounds like he's complaining. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this, quote, Joshua is, quote, thought by many to savor of human infirmity and to be wanting in that reverence and submission he owed to God. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown doesn't say he agrees with those many that say that, and I don't agree with them either. Adam Clark says that Joshua was definitely not culpable. He's saying that Joshua is just repeating what God has said. In Deuteronomy 32, verse 26 and 27, we see this. Yahweh is speaking. He's complaining about the rebellion of the Israelites, and he says, I would have said, I will cut them to pieces. I will remove the memory of them from men, had I not feared the provocation by the enemy that their adversaries would misjudge, that they would say, our hand is triumphant, and the Lord has not done all this. Well, there you see in Deuteronomy 32 the problem that God has, if you can say that God has a problem. I'm speaking somewhat facetiously. The problem is this. He needs to judge his sinful people, but as soon as he judges them, all of God's enemies will say, see there, Yahweh is no good. He doesn't have any power. He can't take care of his people. So God had to constantly balance that out. And ladies and gentlemen, that's still going on today. I mean, if God wiped out the church today for its many sins, what would the anti-Christian progressives, the secular humanists, what would they say? See there, these idiotic Christians who don't believe in science, who don't want to believe in evolution, these reactionaries, they're gone now because their God is not real. It's just a figment of their imaginations. Well, Joshua is using the same argument to God. He's probably hoping that God would give the Israelites a reprieve based on what God had said in Deuteronomy to Moses, based on the fact that God would want to preserve his good name, based on Moses' precedent. I've already read you Deuteronomy 32, verses 26 and 27, but we see the same idea in Exodus 5, 22 and 23. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why have you brought harm to this people? Why did you ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done harm to this people. You have not delivered your people at all. In other words, Moses is not appealing to God's honor here and saying it would be besmirched if you punish the Israelites or wipe them out. But what he is saying is, you haven't delivered the people, and I'm complaining about it. So what the point is here, maybe since Moses complained very openly and honestly to God about his situation, maybe Joshua's doing the same. And I think it's a good application point here to be made, is we need to be honest with God when things aren't going right. We need to say, okay, God, is it my sin? Is it just because I'm not tough enough? If it's not my sin, maybe I'm not tough enough to handle what's going on around me, and I don't like it, or whatever. You know, just be honest with God. I think many people have said that. I'm not the first person to say that, of course, But it needs to be repeated, because a lot of times we say, oh, God is so holy, I can't talk to him. Yes, you can. You can walk straight into the throne room of God, because your key is the blood of Christ, which gives you confident access. We see also this idea of Moses worrying about God's honor if God wipes out the people in punishment in Numbers 14, verses 13 through 17. But Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear of it. In other words, the punishment, the destruction of Israel. For by your strength you brought up this people from their midst, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people. For you, O Lord, are seen eye to eye, while your cloud stands over them, and you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and in a pillar of fire by night. Now, if you slay this people as one man, then the nations who have heard of your fame will say, because the Lord could not bring this people into the land which he promised them by oath, therefore he slaughtered them in the wilderness. But now I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, just as you have declared. In other words, God, don't let them go down, because if the people go down, the people will say, God didn't love them anymore, he hated them. And not only did God hate him, he was not an omnipotent God, because he couldn't bring his people into the land. He's a weak God. We don't want to hurt your honor, God. It's a great argument. I mean, you know, Moses really didn't have much other argument to make, because the people of Israel were such scum buckets that he sort of had to do argue what he did, and he did. And God honored that. He got the people into the promised land. Of course, they did a lot of judgment in the process, too, because all the people 20 and over died in the dust and were buried in the wilderness, but he still got the people over, and over the Jordan into Canaan. And this is a good sermon point too, application point. If someone says, well, I'm destined by God to go to heaven, in other words, I'm eternally saved, I'm eternally secure, which of course you are, but then you say, well, since I'm eternally secure, I can do whatever the heck I want to, and God's going to have to save me, because if something happens to me, then it's going to look like he didn't have the power to preserve me, and that I actually wasn't eternally secure. And all those verses in the scripture that say I'm eternally secure, well, they're not true. Well, anybody that thinks that they can sin, that grace may abound, because God's honor needs to be defended and God's honor needs to be preserved, they're fools, because God is perfectly able to chastise the ever-loving Gehenna out of you and still get you into heaven. Burn up by fire, maybe, but you'll still make it to heaven, but you'll live a miserable life on this planet, on this earth. Why would anybody want to do that? So we see the very last word of this verse is name. Joshua says, and what will you do for your great name or your reputation if you cut us off here because of what happened at Ai? If we keep losing like this, we're going to get wiped out. God, please, you got to save your reputation. Of course, Joshua's also, in fact, I would suggest he's mainly concerned about his and Israel's chances of survival. I'm sure he was worried about God's name too, but I also bet you, being human, he was worried about the survival that of Israel, which might not happen. We go now to Joshua 7, verses 10 through 13. So the Lord said to Joshua, rise up. Well, Joshua's on his face now, dust on his head, groveling in the dust, begging God. So God says, rise up. Why is it that you have fallen on your face? Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant which I commanded them, and they have even taken some of the things under the ban and have both stolen and deceived. Moreover, they have also put them among their own things. Therefore, the sons of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. They turn their backs before their enemies, for they have become accursed. I will not be with you any more unless you destroy the things under the ban from your midst. Rise up. Consecrate the people and say, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, for thus the Lord, the God of Israel, has said, there are things under the ban in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you have removed the things under the ban from your midst. Now, in our last audio, last chapter, we talked about the ban. The Hebrew is karim, a ban, which King James, other versions, translates as accursed. What it means is everything under the ban, if it's something valuable, it belongs to God. If it's something else, it's destroyed by fire. But in any case, the Israelites, soldiers, do not take it for booty. That's basically what the ban means. And somebody, namely Achan, took some of the spoil for booty instead of putting it in the temple treasury or the tabernacle treasury. Now, in verse 10, it says, the Lord said to Joshua, whenever I see that, I always think, how? Direct verbal words? Dreams? Visions? A prophet? Well, it sounds like it's direct verbal talk here. There's a lot of that going on in the Torah with Moses, and I suspect that's what happened here too. Now, why did God tell Joshua to rise up in verse 10? Is he rebuking Joshua for having prayed the way he did? As some people think, oh, you're being too familiar with me, Joshua. You're complaining too much. Or was it rather God says, rise up, Joshua, because he wants to encourage and strengthen Joshua? I think the latter is the case. He's trying to encourage Joshua. And God once again says, Israel has sinned in verse 11. Of course, it was Israel, but it was Israel in the form of one Israelite, Achan, and Achan stood for all of Israel, because Israel was responsible for sin in their midst, even if they personally had not done it. Kind of like the honor code in some old-fashioned educational institutions. You didn't cheat, but if you don't turn in the one who did cheat, you're just as guilty as the one who did cheat. Now, God explains to Joshua in advance what's happened. Somebody's got some stuff under the ban. And as a result, in verse 12, the people have become accursed. Well, that's just like the original curse said. Remember, being put under the ban, King James translates that as having been cursed. The original curse, which was in the previous chapter, Joshua 6, said that everyone who touched banned property or accursed property would also be banned or also be accursed. Joshua 6:18, this is the New American Standard. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them and take some of the things under the ban and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. Don't do it, or Israel will be accursed. Well, as it turns out, Achan became accursed. As we'll see later, he's executed by burning, which is the worst way to go. Now, God tells Joshua in verse 13 to consecrate the people. Consecrate means to dedicate. One of the simplest definitions, theological definitions in the scripture is holy, to be holy, or to sanctify. To sanctify means to consecrate someone, which means to dedicate someone to God and to separate him from the world. And so that's what this means in verse 13. Consecrate the people means to sanctify the people. In fact, the King James translates it that way, is to sanctify the people, which means to make them holy, which means to make them Levitically pure, which means to separate them from the world and dedicate them to God. Now, how would that be done? Either with ceremonial ablutions, pourings of water, prayer, repentance, you know, the usual things you do, fasting maybe, to show that we are now dedicated to God and we repent for this horrible sin of violating the ban. So God tells them, you can't stand before your enemies unless you remove the things under the ban. That's it. You're not going to win. So, of course, they want to get rid of the thing. Now, the things under the ban, who would that be? Would that be Achan, or would that be the stuff that Achan stole and hid under his tent floor? The gold, the silver, and the beautiful Babylonian robe, as we'll see later. Well, I believe that what Joshua meant here was, you cannot stand before your enemies until you have removed the things under the ban, the gold, the silver, and the robe. I don't think they were referring to Achan, but Achan was removed when he was executed. So it amounts to the same thing. In fact, John Gill says that this phrase here doesn't mean just remove the things under the ban, the gold, the silver, and the robe, but it means, this verse means here, according to Gill, that the culprit, Achan, is to be put to death. Doesn't sound like that to me, but anyway, doesn't matter. Like I say, the things were removed from the ban, they were given to the Lord, and Achan, as well as his family, were executed. We go now to Joshua 7, verses 14 through 15. In the morning, then, you shall come near by your tribes, and it shall be that the tribe which the Lord takes by lot shall come near by families, and the family which the Lord takes shall come near by households, and the household which the Lord takes shall come near man by man. It shall be that the one who is taken with the things under the ban shall be burned with fire. And he and all that belongs to him, because he has transgressed the covenant of the Lord, and because he has committed a disgraceful thing in Israel. Now, verse 14 says that you, the Israelites, shall come near to Joshua by your tribes. That's not only to Joshua, actually. It's to Joshua and the 70 elders. How are they come near? By the tribes. That doesn't mean everybody in the tribe. Of course, it means by their representatives. Now, how does the lot work? Well, we start out with the 12 tribes. They come by in front of Joshua and the elders, and they draw lots. How they did it, I don't know. Nobody does. They drew lots, and the one tribe that has the guilty member is chosen. Of course, that was Judah, because Achan was from the tribe of Judah. All right, so then the families in the tribe of Judah, sometimes that's translated as clans, large families, they all march by Joshua and the elders. They draw a lot, and the family that Achan is in wins the prize. They draw the lot. And so now that family is divided up into households, and the different households go before Joshua and elder, and they draw lots, and the particular household that Achan is in wins the prize again. And so then that household goes one by one in front of the Joshua and the elders that draw lots, and guess who won? Achan. And his prize was he got to be lit up like a Roman candle. Got it lit up like a torch. Why? Because he transgressed the covenant of the Lord. Now, what covenant of the Lord did he violate? Well, not the Mosaic covenant, but the covenant which said put everything under the ban in Jericho. That's the covenant. It's a particular covenant. This was stated in Joshua 6:18, but as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban. There's the deal. So that you do not covet them and take some of the things under the ban and make the cap of Israel cursed and bring trouble on it. That's the covenant they broke. And it was not an unintentional covenant. By the way, that transgression in verse 15 was not a unconscious transgression, but was rather a conscious, willful breach of the covenant. Joshua 7:11, a few verses previous, says this, Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant which I commanded them. That, of course, is the covenant in Joshua 6:18, keep the things under the ban. Or don't keep the things under the ban. Joshua 7:11 continues, and they have even taken some of the things under the ban and have both stolen and deceived. Well, stealing and deceiving is an intentional crime. It is not an accident. Moreover, they have also put them among their own things. Again, that's not accidental. That's a cold-blooded, premeditated violation of God's will. Now, a lot was used to find out who the bad guy was, Achan. That had to be supernatural. It wasn't luck. It was supernatural. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown makes the comment, quote, how dreadful must have been Achan's feelings when he saw the slow but certain process of discovery. In other words, the whole nation of Israel was getting narrowed down, tribe by tribe, family by family, household by household, individual by individual, and oh my gosh, I got caught. I've got the lot. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that having been caught this way probably led to his eventual repentance. Well, if Achan did repent, it would have to be before the Israelites executed him and his family. Adam Clark says he hopes he escaped perdition. Maybe he did. I hope so, too. Now, lots were used a lot of time in the Bible. We think of lots as gambling, but it wasn't gambling because God was in charge of the lots. Lots were used to elect Saul as king of Israel. Lots were used to find out who transgressed Saul's military command not to eat honey in 1 Samuel 14, verse 40. Lots were used when the promised land is divided in Numbers 26:55 and Numbers 33:54. The courses of the priest, which course comes in at what time to offer sacrifices in the sanctuary and so forth. They were divided into courses and they would come in, I think it was a month at a time. Well, who came in when was regulated by lot, 1 Chronicles 24:5. A goat had to be chosen. There were two goats. One was sacrificed and one was sent out into the wilderness. And the scapegoat ceremony in Leviticus 16, a lot was used to choose which goat would be the scapegoat. In general, this is what Proverbs 16:33 says about lots. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. See, God's in charge of the lots. It's not just luck. Proverbs 18:18, the cast lot puts an end to strife and decides between the mighty ones. A lot was used to choose a successor apostle to Judas. Acts 1:26, and they drew lots for them, and the lot fell to Matthias, and he was added to the 11 apostles. So that's a very legitimate and useful and usual way, really, of making decisions. In the Old Testament, they just turned it over to God and say, whatever you say here, Lord. Now, Achan in verse 15 was said to be burned by the Israelites. Burning was one of the four capital punishments used by the Jews. According to the Jewish Encyclopedia, these four methods were stoning, burning, slaying, and strangulation. Slaying just means they chop you with a sword, probably behead you. To me, the worst would be burning. I can't think of anything worse than that. Achan was probably burned because the city of Jericho was burned, showing that it was accursed. And since Achan had participated in the fruits of Jericho by stealing gold and silver and a beautiful robe, he was burnt too. Now, verse 15 said that what Achan did was disgraceful. He had committed a disgraceful thing in Israel. Why? Well, he got 36 men killed, if you recall, when the Israeli troops got busted at the gates of Ai and had to flee. 36 of them died. All Israel is now on the verge of defeat. They could have all died if the Aiites had chased them into the camp. They could have really been in a bad mess. And if they had all died, that would have been the end of God's testimony on earth, and you and I would be going to hell. Serious business. We go now to Joshua 7, verses 16 through 19. So Joshua arose early in the morning and brought Israel near by tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken. He brought the family of Judah near, and he took the family of the Zerahites. And he brought the family of the Zerahites near, man by man. And Zabdi was taken. He brought his household, brought Zabdi's household near, man by man. And Achan, son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, was taken. Now remember, the Zerah was the family that came from Judah and Tamar. Judah, the play-pretend prostitute, the virtual prostitute who seduced her father-in-law because she was mad at him. And so Achan got taken. Then Joshua said to Achan in verse 19, "My son, I implore you, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give praise to him, and tell me now what you have done. Do not hide it from me." Now, verse 16, Joshua arose early in the morning. It was going to take a long time to deal with this unpleasant mess. So he started early in the morning, went through the lot procedure. When he finally got to Achan, he said, "My son, I implore you." He addressed him kindly and gently, especially considering what Achan had done. Now, here's some possible reasons why Joshua was so easy on Achan. Option number one, he's trying to make things a little bit easier on Achan because he knew that Achan was doomed. He was going to be executed, and he was just trying to show a little compassion to him because of it. Option number two, this is John Gill. Joshua perhaps wanted Achan's confession so that Achan could get forgiveness from God before he got executed. His body might not be saved, but his soul would be. He wanted him to confess. Option number three, being gentle to Achan was a good precedent for the people. It was a good leadership move by Joshua, because now if anyone else sinned in the future, they could see how humanely Joshua treated the sinner. Of course, the downside of that is a lot of times people misinterpret grace. Oh, the King Alfred of England did not execute those who rose up in rebellion against him. A lot of people look at that and say, that's because King Alfred is a weak king, so I'm going to rise up again in rebellion against him. That's always a problem. Now, the lot had already told Joshua who the sinner was, Achan. But then, in verse 19, Joshua said to Achan, "Tell me now what you have done." Well, why does Joshua need to know what Achan had done, since he already knows that it was Achan who did it? Well, the lot told who did it, but the lot didn't say what he had done or how he had done it or where he had done it. So that Joshua's just asking for the details here. We go now to Joshua 7, verses 20 through 22. So Achan answered Joshua and said, "Truly, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel, and this is what I did. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold 50 shekels in weight, then I coveted them and took them, and behold, they are concealed in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath it." So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran to the tent, and behold, it was concealed in his tent with the silver underneath it. Now, when Achan told Joshua, "I have sinned against the Lord," was this a sincere confession? Adam Clark says, quote, "This seems a very honest and hearty confession, and there is hope that this poor culprit escaped perdition." Well, it sounds sincere to me. Didn't stop him from getting executed, but it does sound sincere. Now, some of the booty that he took unrighteously was a mantle from Shinar. Other translations translate mantle as a cloak, as the Holman Christian Study Bible does it. The Young's Literal Translation says a robe. Where did this robe come from? Adam Clark says, quote, "It is very probable that this was the robe of the king of Jericho. For the same word is used in Jonah 3:6 to express the royal robe of the king of Nineveh, which he laid aside in order to humble himself before God. That makes sense. Jericho had a kingly robe. It's called a robe of Shinar. Shinar is the plain upon which the city of Babylon sat. And Babylon was famous for its gorgeous robes, and it makes sense that the king of Jericho had bought one. Now, there was 200 shekels of silver that Achan had stolen. That's about 5 pounds of silver. That's a good bit. 2.3 kilograms for all of you on the metric system. 50 shekels of gold is about 1.25 pounds. Let me tell you something. You got 1.25 pounds of gold today, that's a lot of gold. That's nothing to sneeze at. Well, when you figure, I don't know how many ounces in a pound, but I know gold is about, what, $3,000-$4,000 an ounce now? You know, so it was considerable booty. He got tempted, and he stole it. Now, Joshua's messengers ran to Achan's tent to discover where this banned substances was hidden. Why did they run? It could be for joy that the crime was discovered. I don't think so. Perhaps they ran there quickly because they were afraid that some of Achan's relatives could get there first to steal away the booty. That makes sense. It could be they just wanted to show that they were diligent in obeying Joshua's orders. Could be all three, of course. But at any rate, they ran there. We go to Joshua 7, verses 23 through 25. They took them from inside the tent. They, as the messengers, took them, the articles that were under the ban, the gold, the silver, and the robe, from inside the tent and brought them to Joshua and to all the sons of Israel. And they poured them out before the Lord. Then Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, the silver, the mantle, the bar of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all that belonged to him, and they brought them up to the valley of Achor. Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." And all Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. Now, the first question you might ask is, why is oxen? Why is donkeys? Why is sheep? Why is tent? Because they were all polluted with the theft of these banned substances, and that's why they all got destroyed, to show the utter horror of violating God's commands. In verse 24, it says, Joshua and all Israel did this, took Achan and the sons and daughters and the mantle and the gold and the silver and the donkeys and the sheep and all. All Israel did that. Well, that would be the leaders of the tribes of Israel. Obviously, 2 million people didn't do all this. It was the leaders of the tribes. And why did they do it? Well, this was to show that this was not just a one-man decision made by Joshua. It was all the leadership of Israel was felt abhorrent about what had happened. Now, there's a question about whether the sons and the daughters were killed, as well as Achan. Some people say they only watched the execution. They weren't executed themselves. This opinion says that the sons and daughters only came to the valley of Achor as witnesses of the execution of their father. Now, here's an argument in favor of Achan alone being stoned. If we read verse 25 with the original Hebrew, this is how it goes. Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." And all Israel stoned him with stones. The NASB has them with stones, so does the Holman Christian Study Bible. But literally, the word there is all Israel stoned him with stones. The KJV note, marginal note, says him, stoned him with stones. The NIV just translates it straight. All Israel stoned him with stones. The New American Standard Bible note, marginal note, says literally him, and all Israel stoned him with stones, not them. Him being Achan, not them being Achan and sons and daughters. The Holman Christian Study Bible marginal note says literally him, and all Israel stoned him with stones. So that's a pretty strong linguistic argument there, that it was only Achan that got stoned. There's another theological argument. Deuteronomy 24:16 says children can't be punished for the sins of their fathers. So why would Joshua and Israel be executing the sons and daughters of Achan when they didn't do anything? Deuteronomy 24:16 says this, "Fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin." Well, to argue against that, and we're going to see in a minute, we do need to argue against that, because the sons and daughters were executed, folks, because in the last part of verse 25, it says, they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones, and the them there is them, it's not him. So the sons and daughters, bye-bye, they got executed. But we got to now decide, well, if they are executed, how is that not violating Deuteronomy 24:16, where sons and daughters aren't executed for the sins of their father? Well, here's an argument against, or an explanation of how this could have happened. First, the judicial law in Deuteronomy 24:16 binds Israel. It does not bind God. Fathers shall be put to death for their sons. That's if you're a Jewish judge, but not if you're God. God can put to death innocent sons for their guilty parents. And here's some examples of where God judges innocent seed, innocent descendants. How about Gehazi? His seed was plagued with leprosy. If you recall Gehazi, he was Elisha's crooked servant who ripped off the Syrian king Naaman. 2 Kings 5:27, therefore Naaman's skin disease will cling to you and your descendants forever, says Elisha. Will cling to you and your descendants, your seed, your offsprings forever. Well, Gehazi's kids didn't do anything worthy of leprosy, but Gehazi managed to bring some bad stuff on his descendants. How about David's innocent son was taken, his life was taken because of the adultery and murder of his father David. Bathsheba was the mother, if you recall that. The kid did not live. That's a famous story. That kid didn't commit adultery and commit murder. Nonetheless, he died. How about Jesus? That's the ultimate example. He was innocent as he could be, and yet God took his life. He had an ulterior purpose, of course, and it was because of the sin that was laid on him by the sins of the world. How about the sins of Adam? The sons of Adam. Aren't they judged for the sins of Adam? You take an innocent baby that is born. He has not had an opportunity yet to commit a sin, at least not that I know of, but he's born in sin, and he's judged. So there's lots of examples of children being judged for the sins of their fathers by God in the scriptures. Now, if you think that's unjust, think about this. How about in human terms, when you see a child, how often are they judged because of the sins of their fathers or their mothers? I know a guy I went to high school with. He had hydrocephalus, large, and had water on the brain, and he walked like he was drunk all the time because of his hydrocephalus. And usually people like that are not very popular. This guy was very popular, but he was foul-mouthed. He did drugs like crazy. They say that when he died prematurely. He had holes all on the top of his mouth from doing all the drugs. It was a tragic case. But his father, and I just recently found out that his father worked for a friend of mine. I didn't know anything about his father. And my friend told me, oh, yeah, man, he was drunk all the time, and he was alcoholic and so forth. And so this son of his had a horrible life, died prematurely because of the sins of the father. Now, he also had committed sins too. But nonetheless, parents do affect the destiny of their kids. You can't avoid that and be a human being. And so we could say, well, the fact that the sons and daughters were taken by or because of Achan's, their father's sins, does not cast aspersions on any of God's righteousness at all. That's just the way it is. I don't think that's a completely strong argument. There's a better argument here in just a minute as to why these sons and daughters were stoned. Well, first of all, we got to establish that they were stoned. And I've already mentioned this. I'll mention it again. The very next phrase after it says he was stoned, it says them were stoned. Let me read it again. Verse 25. And all Israel stoned him with stones in the original Hebrew. And they, Israel, burned them with fire. Well, what does the them refer to? It's got to refer to Achan, his sons, and his daughters after they had stone them with stones. Is that just to burn innocent children for what their father did? I've already made an argument that it was just because God can do what he wants to do, but I don't think that's a good argument. I think the better argument is to say that the reason the sons and daughters were stoned, or burned actually, not stoned, was because they were accessories to Achan's crimes. They weren't innocent, in other words. They at least saw what was going on. They lived in the tent, and here comes Achan with all this banned material. They obviously knew what was going on. They did nothing to report it, and which, by the way, shows that loyalty to family over loyalty to God is not very smart. And so they were accessories to the crime, and that's why they got stoned. Why they got burnt. Now, notice that no mention is made of Achan's wife, and from that we can presume that she knew nothing of the theft. Maybe she was absent at the time or whatever, and she didn't get stoned. It could be that Achan was a widow or a divorcee, but I suspect the real reason was the reason the wife wasn't there, because she wasn't involved in it. She was gone for some reason, didn't know what was going on. All of this, of course, is speculation. I think the best speculation is that the sons and daughters knew what was going on, and they were therefore executed. Now, where were they executed? They were brought up to the Valley of Achor in verse 24. Now, the word Achor means trouble. It was not called the Valley of Achor at the time that Achan was carried there. It was called Achor in anticipation of all the trouble that had come upon Israel because of Achan's misdeeds. Here's what Easton's dictionary says about Achor. Trouble. In other words, it means trouble. A valley near Jericho, so called in consequence of the trouble which the son of Achan caused Israel. The expression Valley of Achor probably became proverbial for that which caused trouble. And when Isaiah refers to it, he uses it in this sense. In other words, Isaiah uses it symbolically. The Valley of Achor, a place for herds to lie down in, i.e. that which had been a source of calamity would become a source of blessing. Hosea also uses the expression in the same sense, the Valley of Achor for a door of hope, i.e. trouble would be turned into joy, despair into hope. That's the metaphorical use of Achor. According to Easton's, the actual Valley of Achor has been identified with the Wadi Kelt. I don't worry about that too much. Now, what the trouble is either is the trouble that God caused Achan for his sin, or the trouble that Achan caused Israel because of the sin. I tend to prefer the latter, that it refers to the trouble that was caused Israel by Achan. We go now to Joshua 7, verse 26, and we will finish this chapter. They raised over him, the Israelites raised over Achan, a great heap of stones that stands to this day, and the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor to this day. First of all, to this day, that's two times the phrase is used, and some people like to say that shows that the book of Joshua was written a long, long time after Joshua died, but it could just mean several years later, when Joshua, as we see in Joshua 24, I think it is, he sat down to write everything down in the book. It just could mean to that day, to the day that Joshua wrote the book. So that's not a proof that Joshua did not write this section of the book, although I know a lot of people debate that. Conservative scholars debate that. Of course, a liberal scholar would debate anything in the past. Did Napoleon exist? Well, I don't know. Might not. Might not have. Not enough manuscripts. All right, these stones, this great heap of stones that's used as a memorial, it was to remind the people of Israel what had happened there. And of course, this was a common practice among heathen nations, ancient and modern. Now, the Valley of Achor is about 12 miles from Jerusalem. That's because that's about where Ai was, according to John Gill. It became famous as a metaphor for trouble. I've already mentioned, Easton's mentioned that. I'll go ahead and quote the scriptures where the Valley of Achor is used as a metaphor. Isaiah 65:10, Sharon will be a pasture land for flocks. Sharon is on the coast there, the southwest coast, if I remember correctly. Will be a pasture land for flocks in the Valley of Achor, a resting place for herds for my people who seek me. And what Isaiah means is the Valley of Achor is trouble, but God's going to change it into a place where herds can rest there, which means it's a place of prosperity. Hosea 2:15, then I will give her vineyards from there, give Israel, and the Valley of Achor as a door of hope. So there, the Valley of Achor, which symbolizes trouble, is changed into a door of hope, something more positive. And she will sing there, Israel will, as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt. So ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished the sad chapter of chapter 7, the setback at Ai by the previously victorious Hebrew troops. We are now prepared to go to Joshua 8, verses 1 through 29. We won't quite finish that chapter. It's too long. We will examine the fall of Ai as defeat at Ai is turned into victory at Ai. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.